Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that talks to people who live lives of excellence. Brought to you by Blinkist, where you find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes so that you can drive them, test drive them, or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Today's guest is, in my view at least, a very special American. He's arguably the finest living historian of the American experience. He's written 30 books or so, and I can say that having read, 15 or 20 of them, they're all exceedingly well-written, crisp and engaging, really sort of written like novels in many cases, or at least with that kind of flair. Some of these books include what I think is the best biography of Ben Franklin, and also the best biography of U.S. Grant. The first one, the Ben Franklin, is called The First American. The U.S. Grant biography is called The Man Who Saved the Union. A really good biography of Ronald Reagan, a book about the California Gold Rush called The Age of Gold. Fine bios of FDR and Theodore Roosevelt, and as well as period pieces about significant eras of U.S. history, like the Cold War. Most great historians tend to specialize in a single period, a topical domain, but you, Professor, you seem to specialize in just about everything in American history, it seems. Professor is the Jack S. Blanton Senior Chair in History at the University of Texas, Hook'em. And your latest book, I just finished two nights ago, is an epic, sweeping epic history of the American West called Dreams of El Dorado. It's really very, very good. And I'm very impressed, as I'll talk about later on with you, how you took key stories, emblematic stories that somehow are really show what the Great West was all about and use them instead of just pounding, history into our heads endlessly, which you could have done, of course. And by the way, if you'd done it, it'd probably been pretty darn good. As I mentioned above, we talked with people. By the way, thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure. Delighted to talk to you, Tim.
Well, I'm very glad to meet you. As I mentioned to you on the notes I sent you, my daughter took your course twice when she was at UT. She was a business. She was in the business school, and when I told her I was interviewing her, first words were, "I want to listen to that, Dad."
Ah, great.
And she loved your course. Yeah, she loved your courses, both of them, very much. You know, as I mentioned above, we talk with people who live lives that are emblematic of the phrase success made to last. So I'd like to ask you about your early path towards your eventual goals. You know, we don't all wake up one day and suddenly we're successful, right? And really writing our 30th book. And in your case, I think two books that were Pulitzer Prize finalists. You were born in Portland, Oregon. Talk about your early life, you know, what you dreamed about and what your early influences were that kind of shaped you, if you don't mind.
When I was a kid, I had no idea I was going to be either a teacher or I was going to be a writer. And those are the two things I've done pretty much my entire adult professional life. But I really didn't anticipate that. If I thought about anything that I would probably be, it was that I would be a business man, a business person, and this because it ran in the family. So my father had a business. He was a wholesaler and importer of cutlery, knives and scissors, things that cut.
Oh, really?
He had acquired the business from his father, who had founded it in 1917. So the business had been in the family for a while, and I pretty much grew up in the business. So from the time I was probably 10 years old, certainly long below the age where child labor laws really would have taken offense if they had known about it. I worked Saturdays, I worked some summers in the business. I would pull orders from shelves, I would pack the items to send them out, I would run errands, and I just sort of grew up around the business. And because that's what I knew, this is, kids
wow.
know in the world that they live in. And it's also the case that most of my parents' friends, their circle, they tended to be business types. Now, there were some lawyers. My maternal grandfather was a lawyer. And, of course, there were the odd doctors that people knew. But most of the people in my parents' circle were business folks. And so I sort of assumed, when you're 8 years old, at least I wasn't thinking of a career, but it just seemed that's what adults did. Now, when I should add, and this is important, that I was a pretty good student. So school came relatively easily to me, and it was something that I liked. But through high school, all the way through high school, I really didn't think what I was going to do for a career. Now, some of this was a reflection of the fact that I was in high school during the 1960s, and I was going to go off to college. And there was a smaller proportion of young folks in those days who went to college than did now. The economy had been doing really well. The American economy had been doing really well for 30 years. So it was just assumed, at least it was assumed by me, that if you did get a college degree, then there would be a job out there for you. And I'll say that as a teacher, so I teach students at UT, including your daughter. And over the last, certainly in the last 10, 12 years, since the financial crisis of 2008, this question of what am I going to do with my college degree has been at the front of my students' attention and especially their parents' attention. But this is something that I didn't really think about. And part of it was because I had the luxury of this backstop of knowing that I could go into the family business. Now, when I went to college, for the first time, I sort of realized that there were other things that people did. And I was around my age peers who had parents who were doctors and lawyers and teachers and professors and other things. And so I started thinking, well, okay, maybe there's something else I could do. And also, I will say that this is just a personal streak in myself, that I'm more likely to not do what is expected of me than to do what is expected of me. It just sort of comes more naturally. And anyway, so I started college as an engineering major. But again, this was because
Did you really? No kidding.
Well, it reflected the fact, first of all, that my father and my uncle, his identity, were both educated as civil engineers. And I had been a tinkerer. I had the popular mechanics from the time I was about 10. And I was always taking things apart and putting them back together. And I really liked it. And so this idea, okay, it seemed to come naturally to me. But I took a couple of engineering courses, and they didn't appeal to me anywhere near as much as my history courses and my mathematics courses. And so in college, I just, okay, forget about engineering. It was kind of a naive initial major, but I started taking this other stuff. And I thought, well, mathematics is something I'm going to major in. And so I was a mathematics major for my first, I guess, 2.5 years of college. And I liked it. I was pretty good at it. And I thought, okay, well, this is going to lead to something. I didn't know what. And for me, history, my history classes, they were simply entertainment. They were to fill out the schedule. And so I took history classes because, oh, that looks interesting, and that looks interesting. And I heard about this professor who's really interesting. And I have to confess that in terms of the classroom experience, my history classes were the most interesting classes that I took. Now, I liked math, but math, the classroom experience wasn't particularly great. The fun for me with that was to puzzle over the problems when I got home. But history, first of all, there was the subject matter, and it was learning about people who had lived before us. But there was also, and I didn't realize this at the time, but there was also the sort of theatrical element of taking history class, because when my chemistry teachers or my biology teachers or my math teachers, they would come in and it was as engaging as the subject might be if you really liked it, the classroom presentation was pretty dry. Whereas the history classes, I mean, this was the stuff of real life. And I had a history professor, he was a German professor, he was visiting from Germany, and he channeled Martin Luther and John Calvin and all the great reformers of the 15th, 16th centuries. And I thought, this was really good stuff. And so I didn't run out of interest in math, but I did run out of interest in the courses that I had to take to support a math major. And I had to take some physics courses. And I always liked my math sort of unadulterated by practice. I just liked pure math. And so when I realized I was going to take this other course I didn't want to take, I just sort of looked and I saw, oh, you know what? I'm within 2 or 3 courses of completing a history major. I think I'll do that. And even then, I had very little thought that I might either be a writer or be a teacher. And in fact, after I got out of college, I did spend a year in the family business and think, well, I ought to give it a try. I did. And it was while I was doing that. In fact, I was selling cutlery across the American West. I had a territory that spanned from Oregon to Colorado. And I was driving across the West, and for my entertainment evenings, I took along a bunch of books to go along with my cutlery samples. And I would read these history books. I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. So after I decided the cutlery business wasn't for me, I said, okay, what do I do now? And I had a couple of teachers in high school that I liked, and I liked their approach to education. So I attended a private high school, a Jesuit high school, and fortunately enough, the principal who had been the principal when I was there was still the principal, and this was only four and a half years ago. And so I called up and I said, do you need any teachers? And he said, well, what can you teach? And I said, what do you need?
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And he said, well, we need a math teacher. And so I was able to parlay I was essentially a double major of history and math. And so I said, I can teach. So I talked myself into a math teaching job. And that's when I started teaching. But the big thing that I discovered within my first 2 days in the classroom was I liked teaching. And this is something that I tell my students if they're thinking of going to teaching. Say, well, that's fine, but until you've been in front of the classroom, you don't know if you want to be a teacher or not. You've all been students, and you probably wouldn't be talking about teaching if you didn't like school and you weren't pretty good at it. But it's a very different thing if you're responsible for the class rather than just sitting there. And I discovered I liked it. And I tell my students, if you get in front of the classroom, you'll know very quickly if you like it or not. And if you do like it, it's a great profession. And I did like it, and it's been a great profession.
You know, I don't know if you looked at my LinkedIn page, but I used to publish books, and we published a book, an old friend of mine and I, back in 2005, called Success Built to Last. And as preparatory to that book, we interviewed 300 people around the world, you know, Nelson Mandela, Maya Angelou, you know, the requisite amount of billionaires, or Richard Branson, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that came through, and it just came through as you spoke as well, is that people who find success, however you wish to define that, follow something that they're passionate about, and it gives them great meaning. And it's clear that teaching and history itself did that for you, didn't it?
Well, I'm going to take slight issue with the way you phrased it. We agree.
Okay.
Because I'm going to say that in my observation, this term, you know, what's your passion? That's a bit overused.
Right.
And the reason I say that is that I get students who are about to graduate, who come into my class, and they feel somehow there's something wrong with them because there's nothing I'm passionate about, they say. And I say, well, don't worry. Most people don't know what they're passionate about.
That's true.
I didn't. And I said, and the way I found my way to what I've been doing these last years is I just sort of gravitated toward those things that appealed to me, that I liked doing it. And I didn't have this drive from the time I was 10 to become a historian or a writer. And some people do. And, you know, that's great. That's one path to success. But another path, and the one that worked for me was just of the alternatives in front of you, what are the ones that are most appealing? And I tell my students, again, these are the ones who they weren't pre-med or they weren't pre-law and they're going to graduate with a degree maybe in history. And what do I do now? And I say, well, you know, go out and look for a job. Don't look for a career yet. Look for a job. Find something you can do. Find out if you're good at other things besides school. To get into UT, I'm sure your daughter was very good student. To get into UT today, you have to be pretty much a straight A student in high school. And so people.
And my daughter came from New Jersey, so it was even worse.
You bet.
Yeah.
And so these are young people who are, they know they're good at school, but I explained that the world's much bigger than school. And get out and find out what else you're good at, because you almost certainly are good at other things. And I sort of revive memories from their geometry classes in high school. And they say, you know, remember the Venn diagram, where you got these overlapping circles. And what you want to do is you find there's one circle of the things that you're interested in. And an interest is something that can grow with the doing. You might not, you don't feel that, you know, I'm going to devote my life to this. No, just, is it something you like doing? And then if you do it, so one circle is the things you're interested in. Another circle is the things that you're good at. And they tend to overlap, but not always. There are some things that, you know, I'd really like to do, but if I'd had my way, I would have played center field for the San Francisco Giants, but I wasn't a good baseball
player. I had the same problem, although it was the Yankees for me.
The model was really nice, so it was kind of hard to match up. Anyway, so find out what you're interested in, find out what you're good at, and the third circle is what somebody will pay you to do.
Right,
and
right.
As you're looking for what your next step is, and this is something that I did. So I got this job teaching because somebody would pay me to teach, and I thought I could probably be reasonably good at it, and it appealed to me. And so this is what I did. And with my students, I said, you know, your first job, don't think of your first job as your career. It's just a job. Take that job and learn something from that job. And the most important thing you might learn will be how to get along with a terrible boss. Because you're going to be dealing with people who have some kind of authority or power over you in your life, and you might not get along with them very well. Or it might be to just discover that the world operates 9 to 5, whereas college students operate, you know, 10 to 3, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So see if you can actually get yourself to show up every day and do all this other stuff. And while you're in your first job, be thinking about what your next job might be. Don't leave too soon. Learn all you can, but think about, okay, what are my other alternatives? And one of the things I do with my students, and this might sound odd coming from somebody in my position, is I discourage them from going to graduate school too soon. In fact, too soon is right out of undergraduate school. I say, get out of school.
I agree. Yes.
And, you know, find out what else you're good at. And then don't come back to graduate school until you have discovered that there is something you want to do, presumably a profession, that requires a graduate degree as the entry ticket. Because this is especially true with history. I have any number of history students who come into my office and say, I want to go to graduate school in history. And I say, why do you want to go to graduate school in history? And they say, because I really like history. I've always liked history. And I say, wrong answer. If you're interested in history, go to the library, go to Amazon, go to the bookstore,
right.
Read history. History is unusually accessible. You can teach yourself better than anybody can teach you. And I point out that if you do go to history graduate school, then history is really going to change for you because it's no longer going to be your interest. It's going to be your job. And once something is your job, it's a different thing than it was before. You're going to
be an animal. That's right.
There's stuff you're going to have to do for your job. Right. There's stuff, books you're going to have to read for your job that you wouldn't have chosen to read. So just go off on your own, teach yourself. And then when you discover that you've hit a roadblock, that you can't do the thing you want to do because you need more education, then go get that more education.
Very good advice. Absolutely good advice. I agree with it. So, you know, I'm the, you said your father's business. It's handed down to him from somebody who's your grandfather who started it in 1917. I'm the son of a person who was born in 1928 up in Paris, Texas in the Dust Bowl. And his father was born in something like 1880, just after the Comanches left my background in Palo Duro Canyon. Does your family go back to the almost to the origins of Oregon? And those stories that you tell in Dreams of El Dorado must have been very close to your heart in the way that a Texan tells the stories of, well, you know, of the Republic of Texas.
My ancestors arrived in the United States. Well, I know that on my father's side, it's my great-great-grandfather who immigrated from, well, he immigrated from Germany. He's Dutch. Franz is a Dutch name. But he emigrated. He had moved from Holland to Germany to the United States. And he wound up in Kentucky. And my grandfather was born in Kentucky. And he was a traveling salesman. And he had a territory. He was selling hardware for a company that was based in Minnesota. And he was selling hardware on the West Coast when in Portland in around 1910 when he ran into the woman who would become my grandmother.
Oh, and wow.
He fell head over heels, and he went back to St. Paul and sort of tidied up his business affairs there and then moved out to Portland and married her. And there's German in her background. And so then they had twins, identical twins, who were my father and my uncle in 1914. And in fact, 2 or 3 days ago would have been my father and my uncle's 106th birthday. But they died in their mid-90s. So, and on my mother's side, it was a little bit unclear because when I tried to quiz my grandmother on this, she was the last member of that side of the family. She had some bad memories of childhood that she didn't want to revisit. And my grandmother, when she didn't want to do something, she didn't do it. So she did say, and I don't know whether to believe it or not, that her parents came to Oregon in a covered wagon. And it's entirely possible. It didn't mean that they were with the first wave of people. In fact, people were still going to the West, going to Oregon and California in covered wagons long after the trains had been moved out there. Because trains are expensive, and if you have to haul household
furniture,
just as nowadays if you're moving.
And if you have no money, yeah.
Right. And so nowadays, if you're moving from Kansas City to Portland, and you're moving a household, you rent a truck, and you rent a U-Haul and take it away. And in those days, you rent or buy a covered wagon, and you make the trip. So it's entirely possible that was the case. But I can't say that for sure that any of my relatives were in on the ground floor of any of the events in the very early history of Oregon. Now, my grandfather was a proud member of the group that built Portland into the thriving metropolis it became, and my father, and he certainly considered himself to be in that line, and my brother did take over the business, and my brother is a pillar of the Portland business community and has made the business a great success.
Yeah, you mentioned covered wagons. My father's mother came across the country from North Carolina in a covered wagon, she told us, in 1904, and settled in, let's see, Oklahoma. It wasn't Oklahoma yet. It was still in the territory, Indian Territory in 1904, I think. So, yeah, people are still doing that, you know, well into the next century. You know, I've lived out here. I live one city north of Austin. I'm in Leander, and I've lived out here for 3.5 years, although I've been coming out to the West since I was born. Almost every year of my life. You know, you're a child of the West, and I remember, you know, when I lived in the Northeast, I remember reading what was now a rather famous interview with Annie Pohl, in which she was interviewed, and she was asked, why after all these years, like 50 or so years of living, I think, in Vermont, did you go to Wyoming, of all places? And her sort of snarky comment was something like, I got tired of the vistas that were half a mile long. And my kids and myself, well, every time we come down here, my kids now live here, of course, both of them, as well as me. But when we used to come down here, we'd get off the plane and we'd start driving, you know, from the Austin airport. We all said, look at that big sky. Doesn't it feel freeing? And it literally was uplifting. I mean, is there something, do you think that Westerners, even today, 130 years after the closing of the American West, still see the world differently than maybe Easterners do? And if so, why? Or why not?
Well, then, I guess.
Or is that just a dumb question?
Sure. No, I guess the answer is some of them do. Not all of them do. And if you lived in, you know, if you moved from Boston to Seattle, you know, I don't think.
Yeah.
You'd be glad you're out of those terrible cold winters, but you ask yourself, where'd all this rain come from?
Yeah, that's terrible rain.
Yeah, but I actually have to add something to what you said about you and your daughter seeing these vistas and Annie Pohl thinking that the horizon was only half a mile away. So I grew up in Western Oregon. And in Western Oregon, there are places in Western Oregon where you can see fairly far. So I grew up, and the places that I lived almost always had a view of Mount Hood, which is about 50 miles to the west of, to the east of Oregon.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you can see this thing on the horizon. But I do remember moving to Texas, and I visited Texas a few times, but I moved to Texas in the early 1980s. And I did get used to these tremendous skies where you get 360 degrees of sky. And moreover, the skies are really interesting because the
yes.
clouds in Texas, they have a lot of character. Now, I grew up in Western Oregon, and there are more clouds in Western Oregon than you want to see in a lifetime. But the thing is, the cloud cover is often so thick that there is no texture to the clouds. There's just this flat gray sky. But then, after being in Texas for a while, when I would go back to Oregon, I'd go back to Oregon at least every summer. And typically what I would do was I'd take my family and kids, and we would fly into Portland Airport, and then we'd get in a car, rent a car, and drive to the Oregon coast, where my parents had a beach house. And when you drive from Portland to the coast, you go through the Coast Range. And the Coast Range is heavily wooded because it gets an average of 80 inches of rain a year. And I would feel like I was driving through a green tunnel where all I could see were the trunks and leaves and boughs of trees that were 30 feet away. And I did get kind of claustrophobic. And when I would get back to Texas, I would get off the plane and say, I can see this.
Yes.
So there is something about that. There is something about the openness of much of the West. And this is why I deliberately chose Seattle as a counterpart to Boston. Because if you're in the corner of the Pacific Northwest, where it's wet and where things grow, then it's a very different outlook on life. But for most of the West, one of the points that I make in my book, Dreams of El Dorado, is the thing that really characterizes the West is that it's dry. And because it's dry, it's open. And because it's open, it's, first of all, relatively lightly populated. But because of that, it seems like there's room for people to do whatever they want to do. In contrast to a big urban area like, you know, the East Coast from Boston to Washington, where you can't go 20 feet without bumping into somebody. There's still parts of the West where you can go 20 miles without hearing anybody. And to a certain personality and temperament, that means a lot. And so I think over the years there has been a lot of self-selection going on. And some of it is just as simple as if you are successful, if you're a member of the upper class in New York, you're not likely to move to the West. I mean, you might buy a ranch, a vacation home in Wyoming, but you're not going to uproot and change your life because your life is really good. And by the same token, if you're really poor, if you're living on the Lower East Side of New York in the 1890s, you're not going West either because you can't afford it. To get to the West requires a certain amount of capital. And so it was always the case that the Westering experience in American history acted as this filter. And it peeled off the upper classes, and it kept out the lowest classes. And so there was this middle slice of America's population that tended to move West. And it did give rise, first of all, to democracy. So America's West was the birthplace of American democracy, where when people got to the West, they first of all didn't have the aristocrats didn't go West, and the really poor people didn't go West, and so they were, to begin with, relatively equal. But furthermore, one of the things that the West did was it rewarded talent and effort. And so people tended to be judged in the frontier communities of the West on what you could do, not who your daddy was. And it helped if you had some money, but still, you know, the money might very well not last very long. And so, and a last thing relating to this, it was in the West that women first got the vote. And women were considered essential to the success of farm, ranches, private businesses, because everybody had to pitch in. So there is a part of the West that persists in American life today. And one of the points that I'm making in the book is, and this is sort of apropos of business success, so I ask readers and I ask listeners when I give talks, so if you had been around in the early 1970s and you saw that, and somehow you knew that there was this new tech revolution that was coming. Where do you think the tech revolution would be based? And I said, in around 1970, you could almost flip a coin. It was either going to be in Boston or in the San Francisco area, because each of those two had, they already had some pre-existing electronics companies, and they also had top-rate universities. And those two are absolutely critical elements of this tech revolution. But Silicon Valley emerged in California, not in Boston. And the argument I make is that it was because California had this history of comfort with taking risks that Boston did not. Boston still labored under the ghosts of the Puritans, who measured material success as a way of gauging the condition of one's soul, which meant that if your business failed, you were supposed to look inward and ask yourself, what's wrong with me? Whereas in California, if your business failed, I posit you got two miners who are members of the gold rush who are out there panning in a stream, and one of them, you know, both sweating under the hot sun, and they're standing up to their waist in freezing cold water, and one reaches down and pulls up a gold nugget and says, Eureka, I've struck it rich. And the other guy standing 20 feet away reaches down and pulls up a rock. And the guy who pulls up a rock doesn't say, what's wrong with me? He says, damn, I got the wrong claim. I got to go get another one. And so in California, the whole idea that you could fail and fail and fail and fail again until you finally succeeded, and that your final success would pay for all of your failures before and more. The third element that was absolutely crucial in the emergence of Silicon Valley was the venture capital industry. And venture capital is exactly this risk-taking enterprise that the California Gold Rush first put in the minds of Westerners.
Well, that was a hell of a good answer. I like that a lot. You know, as I read your book, I just finished reading Lonesome Dove for maybe the 10th time.
Mm-hmm.
Simply a fabulous book. It's funny, every time I read it, I seem to see more in it than I did the last time, which is one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why you reread great books. But, you know, as I read through your book, you know, I thought you did a marvelous job, as, you know, as McMurtry does in Lonesome Dove, really helping us see, as we sit here, you know, in our homes with our air conditioning and all, the constant of pain and isolation and dust and dirt and hardship and violence and death, which were always omnipresent, which is redundant, always omnipresent, which were omnipresent. You know, of course, I'm fascinated by reading books like that, and, you know, reading about Texas History and reading your book, because I think to myself, you know, as I stand, let's say, on one of the hills in here in the hill country and look out for 15 miles and think to myself, my goodness, 150 years ago, I would have been standing here by myself for 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there are a few people down in Austin, of course. And maybe right over the ridge over there might be a tribe of Comanches. In fact, the tribe of Comanches lived just over here in Brushy Creek in the 1830s. How did people do that? Who were these people? I mean, I'm sorry, but they were a little different than us, don't you think?
Yes and no. In fact, one of the striking things about history, and one of the challenges for a historian, whether a writer or a teacher of history, is to bridge the gap between the present and the past, to show how the past was different. And you described it very well, that there were actually Comanches living just over the ridge. And people lived in Austin at the time when there were Comanches just 30, 40 miles away.
Right.
And they knew that there was a possibility that there would be Indian raids, but that was life. And so that's the other half of it. That the challenge is to show how history was different, but then to remind readers or students that to the people who lived it, this was normal. This was their life. And furthermore, they didn't know any more about the future than we know about the future. So today, the question we're all asking ourselves is, how long are we going to be dealing with this coronavirus? Is it going to be another 3 months? Is it going to be another 2 years? And we don't know. Now, when we do know, maybe there's a vaccine that comes along in 6 months, so that 9 months from now, this is just a memory. And then we go and say, okay, life has returned sort of more or less to normal, and some things have changed, a lot of things have come back. And then we say, okay, so this is the new normal. But for the moment, we don't know where that is. And so for people, you ask, so how did these people do it? And they did it, well, they did it just sort of one step at a time, literally, because most of them were but they also did it because at the time they made their decision, it seemed to them to be the best of their alternative. And I'm not going to say that life was hard for them. Now, to our way of thinking, it was hard. To their way of thinking, it was just life. And so if you had to get on a horse and ride 10 miles to get a bag of flour, well, that's what you did. And if you were driving cattle to the ranges of Montana, which is the heart of the story of Lonesome Dove, and it's going to take you 6 months to do it, okay, it takes 6 months to do it. Whereas now, if a flight that across the country that's scheduled for 5 hours, if it's 2 hours late, you know, we get nervous. You know, wait a minute, it's not on time. So all of it has to do with what you're used to and what your options are. And so if people try to, well, so people who went to Oklahoma in the 1890s for the first of the 1889-1890s for the first of the land rushes, well, the land that they claimed was not prime land. There was a reason that it hadn't been settled until then. Now, but it was the best that was available at the time. And strange things can happen. And so you may know the story about the University of Texas and its oil land. So was endowed by the legislature of the state of Texas as stingily as the legislature could contrive. Because, okay, they said we want this university of world class, but they didn't want to fund it. So they said, well, what do we have in Texas? We got lots of, I know, land. Let's give them some land. And it's give them some land out in West Texas. It's not worth anything. We're not going to give them any.
2.2 million acres of it, no less.
Exactly. And so for 40 years after UT got the land, it wasn't worth anything. Then wouldn't you know it, somebody struck oil. So, and this is one of the things that persists, I think, in much of the Western imagination. And I think it's related to the whole Silicon Valley phenomenon, where, you know, these unicorns, these billion-dollar companies just pop up here and there. There is this idea that the stakes that people are willing to play for in the West are greater. You know, I don't think it's any coincidence that the hugely successful tech firms of, you know, of the 21st century, you know, they're based in the West. And this is a place where you can just make this huge fortune. There's almost no limit to what you can accomplish. And it's interesting, but there's some paradoxes involved here. And so I remember this was maybe 15 years ago, I was taking a cab ride in Houston. And Houston is located sort of half in the southeast and half in the west. It's got a foot in both. Mm-hmm. But I was talking to somebody who had been a cab, he was an immigrant. And I can't remember where he was immigrant from. It might have been the Middle East, it might have been Africa. Anyway, he had been a cab driver in Houston before. But then he had relatives in New York. And so he went to New York and lived in New York for a while, but then he came back to Houston because he wanted to start a business. And he said, you know, the thing that I really liked about Houston was that their philosophy seems to be, you know, come on to Houston, do whatever you want. We won't help you, but we won't get in your way. And he said, that's all I wanted. And so there was a lot of this attitude in the West. Now, I'm going to say that in much of the West, this attitude was a bit overblown because the idea of the rugged Western individualist, it's something that is dear to the heart of Westerners. But in historical reality, there is no part of the country that depended more on federal largesse, federal underwriting, than the West. All the irrigation projects of the West, all the big transportation projects of the West, you know, the great industries of the West, including some of the tech companies that depended a lot on research funding from the federal government, and some of them on defense spending. So it's sort of a place where Westerners can have their cake and eat it too, that they can imagine that there are these, that they are these rugged individuals. And I speak as a Westerner here. So we can imagine they were these rugged individualists, but, you know, we spend, half the West is still federal land. So, you know, it's still, and it all was originally federal land. You know, so if Westerners, and some of them do kind of, you get the so-called sagebrush revolution, sagebrush rebellion, when they want the feds to get out of our face. Well, the entire West is a creature of the federal government. It was all federal land. Unlike the original 13 colonies, they were their own colonies. You know, they could have sort of just historical grounds for saying, we were here before there was a Constitution. We were here before there was a United States. Wyoming can't say that. Oregon can't say that. California can't say that.
Very interesting indeed. You know, the American West is a big subject, and you could have written, I don't know, 2,000 pages on it easily. I mean, after all, Stephen Harrigan's, your friend Stephen Harrigan's Big Beautiful Thing is, what, about 900 pages, and that's just Texas. It's a fabulous book, too, by the way.
Yes. But
you used, I think you used a very clever device, you know, to, instead of, as I said earlier, tell us everything that, you know, could possibly have been told about this big subject, and instead use stories, stories about that were emblematic of, you know, major themes, if you will, in the West, whether it was the Gold Rush or whether it's, you know, the uprising in 1836 in Texas, or it's whether it's the Comanches or the Sioux or whatever. And this provides us with a really nice underpinning for those 100 years. And it's amazing when you think about it. The American West was what? Until its closing, just 2 generations, really.
Yeah.
Which we forget. But how did you make, talk about some of the choices you made and why you made them.
Yeah, so the way that I tell history, the way that I write history, and it's also the way that I reflects my own interest in history. And I mentioned earlier that when I was a traveling salesman, a cutlery salesman across the West, I used to pack a whole bunch of history books in the back of my car. And this was in the days before TV, so if I was spending a night in Winnemucca, Nevada, you couldn't even get TV. And so the only thing to do was to read. But very early on, I discovered that the history that I liked most was what I call eyewitness history, an account of somebody who was there. And so I would read the accounts of the explorers. I read the journals of Lewis and Clark and the explorers and the journals of their Canadian counterparts. And I read the diaries of Narcissa Whitman and other people who traveled the Oregon Trail and the letters of people who got to California for the Gold Rush. And to be able to see what they saw and to hear it from their own words. This was what hooked me on history. And this is the way that I try to convey history to other people. And so when I can, as often as I can, I try to step out of the way as the historian and hand it over to the actual expert, the person who was there, the one who experienced it. And so when I find a voice, so I get to tell the story of the discovery, the central discovery of the Grand Canyon, through the eyes and in the voice of John Wesley Powell, who was the first to lead a bunch of boaters down the Grand Canyon and made it to the other end. And he kept a diary about it. And so to me, that's what makes things come alive. And I deliberately do try to, well, make my books read like novels. And so when somebody says, boy, I read your book and, you know, I read the first 50 pages before I didn't realize that it wasn't a novel. Oh, good, good. Because I do want my readers to become emotionally engaged with the characters. Is Narcissa Whitman, is she going to make it across the Great Plains and over the Blue Mountains? And when things get dicey with the Cayuse Indians in Oregon, how's that going to turn out? Is John Wesley Powell and his band, are they going to make it out of the Grand Canyon? Now, most of my readers will imagine, they'll figure out, if I am telling the story of going through the Grand Canyon in the words, the journal of John Wesley Powell, he must have made it out of a canyon. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. But it's a little bit like, as James Cameron, the film director, said, you know, when you're making a film Titanic, yeah, everybody knows before they go in the theater that the ship's going down. But still, you can engage them with the people. Because here's the key, and this is one aspect that I tell about the story, the enduring appeal of that sort of founding story, call it founding myth, like, of Texas, the Battle of the Alamo. The reason that the Alamo has this enduring appeal is that we know, with hindsight, that everybody inside the Alamo is going to die, but they don't know it. And so we imagine, well, what must it be like? You know, and we all know at some level we're going to die. And at some level, at some time or other, we think, well, how am I going to handle approaching death? Well, here are these roughly 200 people who are in the Alamo, and they didn't go to the Alamo to die. They went, they thought they were going to win. But between the time they got there and the start of the battle, they realized we're not going to win. We're not getting out.
No.
And so what were they thinking? And so when I can get the letters from William Travis calling for reinforcement, you know, and saying, you know, that we're going to stand here and we're going to defend this place come death before dishonor. I try to remind my readers that history is made by people who are like you and me. I won't say they're just like you and me, but one of the things that I, well, this is something that I've concluded from history, is that it is misleading to think of, to talk of heroes in history. The way I say it is, there are no heroes. There are just people who sometimes do heroic things. And again, reverting to the Battle of the Alamo, nobody would have called those folks who were defending the Alamo heroes before that battle. In fact, they had a lot to answer for. James was a renegade slave trader. William Travis had left, had abandoned his pregnant wife. He might have killed somebody on the way to Texas. So no one would have named counties or high schools after these people before the Battle of the Alamo. But in that last act of their lives, they behaved very bravely. And so, you know, if we could all have, you know, one good day like that, where we really sort of rise out of ourselves and are better than our ordinary selves, that's sort of the best we can hope for. And so the way I put it to my students is that this is where big history, the history of the Texas Revolution, intersects little history. It's the decisions made by the individuals to go to the Alamo and to stay there. So it's this intersection of big history and little history that I find fascinating. That's the way I try to write my books. So I have this sweeping history of the West, but I tell it through the lives of just ordinary folks like Joe Meek, this guy who grew up in Virginia and decided he didn't want to be a farmer, so he headed west and got talked into becoming a fur trapper. And adventures followed.
Yeah, it's great storytelling. And there's, you know, there's nothing, some people seem to think that when you say that a great historian writes like a novelist, that there's something wrong with that. There's everything right about it, seems to me. And at the end of your book, you know, not to make too much of this parallel, but I you know, the last chapter of your book is a kind of elegy on the death of the West. And it reminded me very much, of course, of Augustus McCrae's comments when he was asked by Clara why he was going to Montana, and he said, well, it's the last place I want to see this free land before all the West is taken over by bankers and lawyers. And there's a, you know, hanging over that novel and then hanging over your book at the end is that Findus de Clay feeling that, despite all of the, you know, all of the things that, you know, some of which are tragedies through all that period. Or as Gus says when they're in San Antonio to Woodrow Call, he says, you know, we killed off all the Indians and all the bandits. We killed off all the interesting people. There's something, you know, there's something sad about all that because endings are sad. And you did a great job at the end of the book, I think, you know, giving that feeling of bittersweetness. And I also wanted to ask you, it's a real nice touch to start the book off with Theodore Roosevelt and end it with him as well. Talk a little bit about those decisions. He's clearly one of your favorites. Hard not to be, I guess.
Well, in fact, when I wrote a book about Theodore Roosevelt, it was called T.R., and the subtitle was The Last Grand. And that Theodore Roosevelt was this transition figure, that he was an Easterner who really found his calling in the West. And he had no reason to expect he was going to find it there, but he did. And it had to do with his own personal circumstances. He went out to the West originally on a buffalo hunt because he had become a hunter and he had heard about all these buffalo in the West, but he also heard that their numbers were declining. He wanted to get out there and shoot a buffalo before they were all gone. Well, he got out there and he actually sort of shot almost the last buffalo in Dakota Territory. Took him more than a week simply to find one. If he had come 10 years earlier, he would have found millions. He couldn't have avoided them. And so his first exposure to the West showed him that the West was already changing. That it wasn't disappearing exactly, but it wasn't what it had been before. But he became very intrigued by this. And then a year later, when his wife died in childbirth and he was distraught, he went to the West to sort of soothe his soul, to get away from the scenes that reminded him of his grief. And to go into these vast open spaces, he was in the Badlands of the Dakotas, and his mind could just wander, and it could sort of be absorbed by the skies, by the landscape, by everything around him. And it was this Western experience that made him appealing to Americans, because nobody ever got elected president from the silk stocking congressional districts of Manhattan. But a man of the West, in fact, I think, one of my last chapters, I can't remember if I actually did keep the chapter title, but I described Theodore Roosevelt as the first Western president. Because although residence was always in New York, but still, he was seen as this man of the West. But he becomes, and as president, he was the most important resident of the White House on the subject of conservation. He realized that there were parts of the West that were going to disappear unless something was done to preserve it. And so Theodore Roosevelt was one who created most of the national forests and set aside most of the grasslands and preserved national parks and there's all this stuff. So he knew that there were parts of the West that needed preserving. You simply, as he liked to say, you can't improve on Yosemite and Yellowstone. Those have to be preserved just as they are. Now, there are other parts of the West where you can cut the timber, where you can dam the rivers, and you can make some good out of them. But still, the West is this different place. But Roosevelt realized that the West was changing, and in fact, some of his friends, they could see the West really changing before their eyes. And one of his good buddies was Owen Wister, who wrote the first great Western novel, The Virginian. And it took me forever to figure out that you could write a Western novel and call it The Virginian. Wait, that's not the West. No, but it's this guy from Virginia who goes out to the West. And Wister, when he writes the book, he explains in a foreword, he started writing the book about the West when the West was the West. And he said he started writing it in the present tense because he was writing it in the 1880s when the things that he was describing were happening before his eyes. But he didn't get around to finishing and publishing until about 20 years later when he said, I got to go back and put it in the past tense because that's no longer the West as it was. And so there's this critical moment, really. It's about two decades. It's the last decade of the 19th century, the first decade of the 20th century, where the West is slipping away. And for many people, it was about much more than the West, because the West was always the region of the country that was sort of archetypally American. Americans have looked West from before they got on the boats to go to Jamestown and Plymouth Rock. They were heading West, because the East, Europe then, was too small for them and what they demanded of life. And as soon as they got to Jamestown, the West began 100 yards inland from Jamestown. But the West kept moving. But it was by the end of the 19th century that the West had hit the Pacific, and there was nowhere else to go. And it was filling in. And so the West began to look more like the East. And in my book, I describe the reason why I end at the beginning of the 20th century, because the 20th century West is not that much different from the 20th century East or Midwest or South. If you want to know what Los Angeles in the 1960s is like, well, you could look at Kansas City or Atlanta or, you know, Detroit, and you get a pretty good approximation. San Francisco in the 1850s is this thing apart. It's a very different world. It's the California of the Gold Rush. San Francisco in the 1950s, well, it's still distinctive, but the problem with San Francisco in the 1950s is the problems of cities all over the country. So if in the 19th century that the West is this place that is really different, and it still holds for Americans the idea that, boy, if things get bad here in the East, we can move West, we can start over again, we can follow Horace Greeley's advice, go West, young man. And people still do, although nowadays if you're in California, California is so expensive, you are as likely to go East for opportunity. So
you're going to go to Texas.
Exactly.
Like Joe Rogan. Oh, goodness. You know, it's amazing. You know, the Western novel, 1902. You know, I had never really thought in my mind. I read it about 2 years ago for the first time, but I'd never thought in my mind. You mean the first Western novel was 1902, and in and of itself, that tells you that the period had ended, in a way, doesn't it? You know, well, like, now civilization is here; we can write about it.
And artists like Frederick Remington, they dined out on the West, because the West was this place that everybody else in America thought was different, and it's still the case today that if you mention to somebody from Vermont that you live in Texas, they conjure these images of Texas. They're not thinking of downtown Houston. You know, they're thinking of Palo Duro or someplace like that. And so it has this image. And there's one thing that the West has going for it, which is a little bit ironic, and that is it's the image of the cowboy. And the cowboy, Larry McMurtry actually had a really interesting essay on why the cowboy was published in, I don't know, Atlantic or Saturday Evening Post or something in the 1970s. And he was talking about why the cowboy is this mythic figure in American history. And he says it has everything to do with the fact that the cowboy is mounted on a horse. And so the cowboy sits above everybody else. Whereas you can't have that kind of mythic figure if you're behind a plow. You know, if you're walking behind a plow, or if you're standing on an assembly line. But the cowboy on the horse stands up. And the cowboy, you know, has often been likened to the knights of the Middle Ages. But it has, and also because the cowboys, so I'm looking at Palo Duro behind you, and you can imagine a cowboy, it could be an Indian, also on horseback, standing on that ridgeline and stands out. And just by itself, it sort of conjures that, well, here's this individualist. Of course, the individualist has his trusty pony or horse, and so this, he isn't all by himself, but it just taps something in us. And so one of the ironic things about it is that cowboys did not inhabit most of the West. Most of the West didn't have cowboys, and there were more cowboys in Florida than there were in Nevada. And for that matter, the age of the cowboy in the West, and the cowboy we're talking about here is the cowboy on cattle drives. And so Lonesome Dove, it's
mm-hmm,
a cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, that particular drive was unusual because the age of the long drives was mostly over. It only lasted about 10 years between the end of the Civil War and the time that railroads got to Texas. And the only reason, they didn't go on these cattle drives for fun. They went there because the only way you could get the cattle to the slaughterhouses in Chicago was to walk them 800 miles to the rail lines in Kansas. And as soon as the rail lines got to Texas, you don't need the cattle drives anymore. But Gus and Woodrow, you got to get that last one in.
By Gus and Woodrow, if it's okay to ask, what are you working on now? I mean, you've written just about, in every era, but there's always something else to write about. What are you working on now?
So the book that I am actually going to be published in October is...
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so it's a more personal thing. I mean, not personal to me, but it's two individuals. And it focuses on Abraham Lincoln and John Brown, the abolitionist.
Ooh.
And this is really sort of getting back to this idea that I was mentioning earlier about where big history intersects little history. And the big history, the big historical question, the question that I pose for readers and I pose for my two subjects is, what does a good man do when his country, when his society is engaged in a great evil? So both Abraham Lincoln and John Brown had concluded that slavery was evil, and somehow or other it must be ended. But they came to very different conclusions on how to do that, what they should do. And John Brown chose an armed uprising. He chose the path of violence. And John Brown, you can't get around the fact that if John Brown were alive today, he would be called a terrorist, because he killed people for political effect, to show his opposition to slavery and to kill people who were in favor of slavery. And he tried to instigate an armed uprising that would have been exceedingly violent of slaves against their masters at Harper's Ferry, Virginia in 1859. Abraham Lincoln, on the other hand, he eschewed violence in favor of working through the political system. And the great irony of their story is that the war that John Brown tried to start fizzled. It didn't go anywhere. And the war that Abraham Lincoln tried to prevent came, and it was the worst war in American history. So this is the book is called The Zealot and the Emancipator. The Zealot
oh, wow.
The Emancipator is Abraham Lincoln.
So it's not up on Amazon then, because I didn't see it, or maybe I just didn't see it, that's all.
I'm not sure if it's available for advanced purchase yet or not. It will be fairly soon. It's the on sale date is, I think, the first Tuesday in October.
Well, and I'll have to line that one up. That's a wonderful premise for a book. That's one of the things that you've clearly specialized in thinking about history in such a way that we can really become engaged in it. My daughter shared with me when she was in your classes the questions that you asked for their essays, because she was fascinated by how good they were. And I was so impressed, I'm not trying to blow smoke up your skirt, but I was so impressed with the fact that those questions, almost all of them, require the students to have really thought about what you'd ask them to read, not regurgitate what you'd ask them to read. And some of them actually, would require them to think off the page, if you will.
Oh.
And I thought that was fabulous. In fact, I enjoy just reading the questions. I mean, maybe I'm a bit of a nutcase. I love history myself. So, maybe I'd have a greater empathy for that. But I do appreciate it. And I see that in your work all the time. And I must say that, Dreams of El Dorado is a fabulous book, and just everything that I've read by it is fabulous, and we wish you all the best of luck. I do appreciate you being on for this much time, and I can see why my daughter thought your classes were so engaging, because it's been a lot of fun to talk to you. And I might, unless you mind, I might have to reach out to you maybe in October or November to talk about that book.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah,
this has been fun.
Well, it's been great for me, and let me just sign off for the ending here. I hope you all enjoyed this out there in podcast land, and remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, filled with fun information, or at least I think so, about our future guests and great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, etc., and rate our show, please. Till the next time, go out there and live the best version of you. Cheers. I'll send you, Professor, the links on the day that we're releasing this so that you can,
okay,
do whatever it is you like to promote it, to the people that know you. And again, thank you. It's a tremendous honor. It's really a lot of pleasure. It was a tremendous pleasure to talk with you. I worked up, so many questions that I didn't put on the sheet because I didn't want to have a 3-hour conversation, but your work is fabulous, and you should be very pleased. Brings me great joy to read your stuff, so thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So I want to tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, and it can work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute or lunch break or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg, two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist.